Good morning. Did you set your clock? Wait, forward, right? You spring forward, fall back. Is that right? Yeah, awesome. I'm glad you're here this morning. My wife and I, years ago, I never will forget, we got married and you have your first Christmas together, and that's awesome and great. And it's that year of first Super Bowl together, first, trip to the in-laws as husband and wife. And of course, the first Christmas is fun. And the first Christmas tree, we bought a real Christmas tree because, that just seemed more organic and authentic and all those fun things. And then I never forget, and we were kind of like, without kids for several years. And then I remember the first Christmas we have kids. And suddenly it's like you get around sort of the end of November, you start thinking about putting up the tree. And it was that thought of, we have kids and they're going to like pull all of our cool ornaments. It's like, husband, wife's first vacation, it's like all those cute little Hallmark ornaments. Like, oh, no, why don't they pull them off and break them? Some of those are heirlooms. Some of those, our parents gave us for our tree now. And it's like, or what if they pull the tree over and the whole thing collapses and breaks everything? And so I said, we've got to do something. We've got to figure out a way to protect the Christmas tree. And so I was actually at Petco and I found this. Yeah, so you thought it was for kids. You thought it was for your children. This is actually for your dog. This little great little fence. Well, check this thing out here. If I can rig this up here, you can put this around. So we put our tree up and then we put this thing around our tree. Safe zone, put the tree back and it's like, that's perfect. I tried to breach the gate, we had to reinforce it a time or two, but, this was our boundary to protect our Christmas tree. And it worked, until they got old enough and then we, take it down or if you have animals, you can put it up. So it worked great. This morning, we've been talking about boundaries. I mean, we've been talking about margin. This morning, we're going to talk about boundaries. We talked a couple weeks ago, we talked about margin, and margin being that what I have available beyond or above what is necessary, right? So same example, if you got $100, you got $80 of bills, you got $20 of margin, right? And I found that margin is something that we can get in our lives, but keeping it is hard, right? And so it's like, I think my margin for like listening to campaign rhetoric is used up. I have no more margin for that. I think I'm done. But margin, so we talked about margin, the importance of margin. The first week we kicked this thing off, we looked at burnout. We said burnout is the result of having no margin. And sadly, that's where a lot of us are today. We have no margin in our lives, no margin in our relationships, no margin in our schedules, no margin in our finances, no margin in our life. And we're on the verge of collapse. Some of you are at serious, you're running life at a seriously dangerous pace, a pace that is unbiblical and unsustainable because you have no margin in your life. You're running at 110, 120% and you only have 100%. Okay. And so burnout is the result of margin. And if you have no margin in life, that's the danger that you're facing. Last week, if you were here, we talked about busyness. Busyness is the arch enemy of margin, and busyness attacks any margin we have and comes calling with, you need to do this. And what about this? And you haven't thought about this, and you ought to come be a part of this. And just all these opportunities that find their way into our life or things happen, the unexpected, and suddenly your margin is gone. And we talked about busyness and the dangers of busyness and how to what busyness does if we don't control it. So this week, I want to talk to you about the protector of your margin, how to protect your margin, the guardian of your margin, if you will. And that's boundaries and learning to establish healthy boundaries in your life to guard and protect your margin. Because guys, I hope you're getting this by now. If you've been here or if you've been listening, I hope that margin is important. And having margin in our life is vital to our overall health, spiritual, physical health, mental health, relational health. Margin is vital because it's in the margin. It's in the margin. When we create margin and we have time left over, we have money left over, it's in the margin that oftentimes the really neat things happen. And so we need that margin. So we're going to talk about boundaries today. And then next Sunday, I hope you'll come back. We'll wrap this thing up. And we're going to just take a look at the life of margin, the blessed life, what that looks like. Imagine what your life could be if you had margin in your life on a regular basis. You learned how to get it and you learned how to maintain it. And so we'll wrap that up next week. But this week we want to talk about boundaries. And there's a great example in the Bible of an individual who I believe is just a great picture of what it looks like to have boundaries, purposeful, intentional boundaries in your life and the difference that it makes. If you have a Bible this morning, I hope you bring your Bible to church. If you don't, we put Bibles in the chairs. There's probably one in one of those chairs in front of you. You can grab that and go to the book in the Old Testament, the book of Daniel. If you're not quite sure where that's at, you go to the front of most Bibles have a table of contents. You can look at the table of contents, find the book of Daniel in the Old Testament, give you a page number. You can turn to it. Daniel chapter 1. We'll also put the scriptures and stuff on the screen. You can follow along that way as well. If you'd like to, if you're using your mobile device, whatever, I'm going to be using the New Living Translation. So if you want to follow along with that translation this morning, you can do that. The book of Daniel in the Old Testament is primarily about Daniel. He's sort of the main character in this. And there's a lot of prophecy towards the end of this book. But in the first few chapters, it's kind of the story of Daniel and some of the amazing things that happened in his life. And let me just give you a little background here, because we're going to kind of jump right into a scenario. But Daniel is part of the Hebrew people, part of the nation of Israel. But he comes about during a time when they're not so faithful to God and they're not following God. And it's just this season of on again, off again, on again, off again. And finally, God just has enough. He's come to him and come to him and come to him and warned them about not following him, not being faithful. And finally just says, all right, I'm going to give you over to this. And King Nebuchadnezzar is the king of the Babylonian Empire, and he comes in and basically takes the nation and overturns the nation and takes a lot of the people into captivity. But then Nebuchadnezzar comes to his chief of staff and he says, listen, there's some really sharp individuals in this group. I want you to bring the sharpest ones, the ones with the most uptick. I want you to bring the guys that are good looking, the guys that are sharp, that are smart, that are intelligent, that are just really seem to have a lot of potential, you know, athletic, strong. I want you to bring those guys, the cream of the crop, if you will. I want you to bring those guys in and we're going to train them. We're going to teach them our language for 3 years. We're going to teach them our language. We're going to teach them our customs, our history, our religion, our practices, just our culture and everything. And then we're going to allow them to, you know, use their abilities for our good. So Nebuchadnezzar's his chief of staff, one of his main guys, comes and he starts selecting these men. And Daniel is one of those men. And they rename them and they bring them in and they basically say, now, guys, here's what we're going to do. And by the way, this is really a good gig for you guys, because we're also going to feed you well. We're going to house you well. We're going to feed you well. Matter of fact, we're going to feed you the portions of food that the king himself eats. It's awesome stuff. You're going to really like this. So they bring them in, and this is where we pick up the story, because when Daniel hears this about the food, he has a problem. Daniel chapter 1, beginning in verse 8, says this. But Daniel was determined not to defile himself by eating the food and wine given to them by the king. He asked the chief of staff for permission not to eat these unacceptable foods. All right. These unacceptable foods, the Hebrew custom and the law of God, God gave them certain laws and regulations, dietary regulations, certain foods they could eat and could not eat, meats if they had been offered to idols, sacrifice. I mean, these are just considered unacceptable foods. They were not to eat these things. Certain meats were considered unclean and you could not eat this. And this was their custom. This was God's law for his people. So Daniel is uprooted from his home, his country, his culture, his people, his family, and he's put in a foreign land with a foreign culture, and he's being taught and trained to think differently. And he's like, you know what, this is okay. I'll learn the language. I mean, that could be helpful and handy. I'm going to learn history, the customs. We'll see where this goes. You know, I'm going to trust the sovereignty of God. I'm going to learn. But then they come to this food and say, we're going to feed you this. And he says, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I can't do that. And so he asks the guy, says, hey, can I take a rain check on the food? I'm fine with, you know, I'll learn this stuff. I'll go to the classes. I'll walk through the training, but I can't eat this stuff. It's just, it's unacceptable according to my faith. Now, let me ask you a question. Just honestly, I mean, does that really seem like a big deal? I mean, it's just food. It's like, you know, I mean, it's just food, man. I mean, just, it's, you know, it's, we got a digestive system. It's going to process. It's going to work. And, you know, I mean, it's just, is that really a big deal? And you know what? In a culture that really doesn't recognize God, really doesn't see God as a big deal, doesn't honor God, that's not probably a big deal. It's like, dude, it's just food. And I'm sure that the leaders here in Babylonia was like, dude, what's your deal, man? This is just food. Just eat it. But you see, for Daniel, those dietary restrictions, that was a boundary for him. He says, I'm not gonna do this. He says he was determined not to defile himself. I'm not gonna eat this food. And so he asked the leader, says, hey, can you just, I just can't do this. Well, the leader comes back to him and says, listen, man, he says there in verse 9, he says, now God had given the chief of staff both respect and affection for Daniel. He liked Daniel, but he responds, he says, man, I'm afraid of my lord, the king, my boss. He's ordered that you eat this food and wine. If you become pale and thin compared to the other youths of your age, I'm afraid the king will have me beheaded. It's like, dude, you don't understand. Listen, I like you and you're sharp and you're smart and I get what you're saying, but you got to understand my position here. The king has ordered this. And if I let you not eat this food that I'm supposed to be feeding you, and you get sick or he comes to inspect to see how you're doing and you're not looking so great, he's going to want to know why. And if it comes out that I let this happen, I could lose my head. This is serious. So Daniel spoke to the attendant and he says this. He says, listen, verse 12. He says, why don't you test us for 10 days on a diet of vegetables and water? At the end of the 10 days, see how we look compared to the other young men who are eating the king's food. Then make your decision in light of what you see. So the attendant agreed to Daniel's suggestion and he tested them for 10 days. He says, okay, that's fair enough. 10 days. We'll do this. See how this works. At the end of the 10 days, Daniel and his three friends looked healthier and better nourished than the young men who had been eating the food assigned to the king. Just a couple of points I want to make right here. Number one is, this Babylonian Empire and King Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon represents a culture that doesn't recognize God, okay? They had many gods, multiple gods, and the king oftentimes saw himself as the god. And this is a culture that does not recognize God, that feels no obligation to God whatsoever. It is not a Christian, godly nation. So they eat whatever. They don't have any restrictions on what to eat. They don't have any, I mean, God is just not in their equation, their practices, their anything. And that's kind of like the culture that we live in today. You know, the history of America, we hear a lot of times about, you know, it's the founding fathers and we've, you know, found this Christian nation. And there certainly was a huge influence of Christianity on this nation. But the reality is where we stand today, we are quickly drifting from any such foundation, any such founding as a Christian nation. We are quickly moving into an era and a day and a season, a post-Christian, a post-church era where, I mean, God is really not, I mean, bringing God into the marketplace of ideas, into our politics, into any aspect of life is just kind of like, we don't really need to go there. We're not really embracing the idea of a Christian nation. If you guys want to practice your religion, you do that, but we're not really a Christian nation. That's not our focus. And we find ourselves as Christians so many times sort of, you know, butting up against a culture that really doesn't feel any obligation to honor the things of God. You ever been there? You ever experienced that? Sometimes it's not huge or enormous. Sometimes it may seem something kind of trivial, like food. What are you going to eat here? Maybe it's like in the area of entertainment. Well, you mean you're not gonna let your kids watch that? Well, I just don't really feel like that's appropriate. It's like, oh, come on. Is it really that big of a deal if they see this? Well, maybe not, but you know, I just feel in my heart, I just kind of feel like there's a boundary there, and I just don't think we're gonna go there. Ever know that pressure? Maybe it's in some other area, and maybe your family, maybe your friends, and it's just like, oh, really? You're gonna kind of be a goody two shoes on that? I mean, you know what? That's kind of old fashioned anyway. We run into those things a lot. And the question comes, it's like, do I have boundaries in my life? Have I set some things up like Daniel that says, you know what, I'm not going to cross this boundary. And I believe Daniel was ready to suffer the consequences. The attendant agrees to his plan here to test him, and it turns out favorable. They comes back and checks on these guys and like, wow, you guys look healthier and more vibrant and alive and smarter and sharper than the guys that have been over here eating the king's food. And you've been eating this vegetable and water. And it's like, wow, well, I'll go along with it. So he didn't have to, but I believe he was ready to suffer if it had been pushed and said, no, you will eat this. I believe he said, I'm not going to do this. And I believe that because when we read on in the story of Daniel, we see in other times when they come to Daniel and they say, listen, you can't pray to your God anymore. It's outlawed. Daniel says, that's a boundary for me. I believe in the one true God. This is my God. I'm going to pray to him and I don't care. I'll suffer the consequences. Well, if you keep doing that, you're going to end up in the lion's den. Well, then throw me in the lion's den. This is a boundary. I'm not going to defile this. And they throw him in the lion's den. His three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Another instance, they come to them and they're like, hey, you know, we've got this big, huge statue and everybody's got to bow down and worship it when they hear the music playing. And they're like, we ain't going to do that. We got a boundary here, man. We serve one God and it ain't that big, tall statue. We're not bowing down to that thing. And they get ratted out. Hey, they're not bowing down. Get in here. What's this I hear? King, listen, you're the king, but man, we serve the one true God. We're not bowing down. You will be thrown in the fire furnace. Okay. You can throw us in there. We believe our God can save us. But even if he doesn't, listen, we are not going to compromise this boundary. We see these guys ready to say, we are not going, these are boundaries, and we're not going to defile ourselves here. In the story of Daniel, those two incidents, the fiery furnace and the lion's den, we see two supernatural, miraculous interventions of God. The lions, it says he shut the mouths of the lions. They didn't eat Daniel. He said those three men stand in the midst of that fiery furnace, and they come out and don't even smell like smoke. I mean, that's supernatural divine intervention, okay? No hazmat suits, no, you know, fire retardant wear. I mean, it was just thrown in there and God protects them. But now here's the reality. God doesn't always do that. Sometimes people take a stand and they say, I got a boundary here. I'm not crossing it. They take a stand and they suffer consequences. Persecution. So what we can't say this morning is, hey, you draw a line in the sand, you set up a boundary, God's got your back, you'll never suffer, you'll never pay the, it'll all go well with you. Sometimes God intervenes like that, and sometimes you do suffer. But what I can say is that there is a lifestyle, there is a path that God won't bless, can't bless. And that is the decision to drop the boundaries. And say, no boundaries. You know, it's food's not a big deal. And can't you imagine some of Daniel's friends during that 10 days at mealtime? They bring in the cart and here's the meat and the cheese and the food and the sweets and the wine. And they're chowing down. They've been studying and working hard all day. And they're sitting over there eating this awesome stuff. And Daniel and his buddies are eating carrots and, you know, potatoes and drinking water. Can't you just see some of their own people? It's like, what you guys are missing. Man, the Babylonians know how to make wine, guys. I'm just telling you, I don't know how the water is, but this stuff. I mean, can't you just see the pressure? But they're like, you know what? This is a boundary. We're not going to go there. And God blessed that. He blessed that in when they examined them. They found them. It's like, man, you guys are doing great. The other guys, not so much. They didn't distinguish themselves. Truth of the matter is they probably just kind of blended in with the Babylonian culture, which is typically what happens when Christians don't have boundaries and just decide, that's probably not a big deal. And we compromise. We just sort of blend in with the culture. Because what I found is when I don't set boundaries in my life and I don't guard those boundaries, the ideas of a culture that doesn't recognize God actually starts making sense to me. It's kind of appealing. And I'm like, well, maybe it's not such a big deal. But I've learned in my life that's a decision God doesn't bless. Nothing good comes out of that. God's heart and plan is, regardless of the circumstances, that his people distinguish themselves from a culture that doesn't honor God. And that's what Daniel and his friends did. That's what believers do today when they set up proper boundaries and they protect the margin in their lives. And as a result of that, their relationship with God is allowed to flourish and grow, and they grow, and there's margin in their relationships. They have margin in their time. They have margin in their spiritual development. And there's a difference in their lives, and it's visible. The problem in the church today is that there's not a lot of distinction between those that call themselves followers of Christ and those who do not. And it ought not to be that way. And I think it comes down to this idea of margin and the fact that we have no margin. We talked last week that when we have no margin in our lives, one of the impacts, one of the results of that is spiritual barrenness, lack of depth. You're just busy. And you're running after the things of this culture and this world, and there's not really time to stop and say, is this even what God has for me? Daniel determined in his heart, I'm going to establish these boundaries. I'm not going to cross these boundaries. These boundaries are there to protect my heart, to protect my soul, to protect my mind, and I'm not going to compromise. So I think what we need in our lives today is we need boundaries. And I got to think about boundaries this week. And there's a lot of things we could talk about as far as boundaries. But I want to mention just three this morning. Three boundaries that I'm not saying these are the most important, but I think they probably need to be mentioned in any list of important boundaries. I do believe that if we could get these three boundaries in our lives on a regular basis, there would be a distinguishable difference in the aroma of our lives versus that of those who do not follow Christ. And I want to share those with you this morning. And you can jot these down if you'd like to. The first boundary that we need to have in our lives is the boundary of contentment. Contentment. We are a very discontented culture and people. I mean, just think about how often throughout your day you are discontented. The drive-through line isn't moving fast enough for you. The supper that your spouse made isn't really what you wanted. The kids aren't doing like you wanted them to. This event or this workshop didn't really go the way you wanted it to, or this didn't happen, or the neighbor didn't really do what this, or that didn't. That's not going the way you like. The lawnmower's not running the way you wanted. That car you bought is not really, you know, performing like you had hoped, like you'd, I mean, just all multiple times every day, just opportunities to be discontented. And the truth of the matter is, contentment in a godless culture is actually a bad word. It's a negative concept. And I say that because the sheer amount of resources our culture, that again is, we're talking about culture that's not governed by God's standards. The amount of resources our culture expends annually to destroy contentment. And there's two main areas that this happens, I think. The first one is in the advertising and commercial area. We spend $250 to $300 billion annually to convince you and me that we're not content with what we have. If they spend that kind of money on television commercials, magazine ads, billboards, flyers, mailers, if they spend that kind of money to convince us that we need stuff, to convince us that we don't have enough, then it must work. And I think it does. Think of some of the things our culture has convinced us we need. How about this one? The Pet Rock. First 6 months on the market, $15 million in sales. The Creator had they sold for $3.95, comes complete with straw to keep it soft and comfortable, and a manual on how the care and training of your pet rock. And millions of Americans needed this. He had sold for $3.95 a piece. He had 95 cents invested in each one. He made $3 profit on every one sold. And we needed it. I'm like, for crying out loud, I'll save you $2.50. I'll give you your rock. I'll create a manual for you. You give me $2.50. You have a pet rock. Save yourself somebody. Go in your backyard. But we got to have a pet rock. You put a rock in a box, put a label on it, and put a book in it, how to take care of it. And suddenly you've created something that we need. Some of you are like, I got a pet rock, man. You know, this is awesome. What are you talking about? I'm going to start recycling like all my old tennis shoes, pet shoes, you know. It's like, get them now. It's the latest, greatest thing. Got to have it. Got to have this. You know who's the best at this? It's really the technology, and specifically, most recently, it's been, you know, Apple and the iPhone, you know, and the whatever, the iPad, the whatever, you know. And I mean, because the new one comes out, I mean, lines, people camp out. You got to get one before it sells, you know, gets sold out and on and on. And we're just driven by this. And look, this is an iPhone 4. I can't download half the apps that most of you can. This thing, it won't work half the time. I have to restart it. I mean, it's, you know, there's just a lot. I mean, notices come up. I don't understand. I mean, there's a lot of things. It's just not, that's not the latest, greatest. I've never even upgraded to the latest I'm like two or three operating systems behind. I mean, but you know what? It still works. I called my mom yesterday. I sent my wife a text this morning. You know, I can check the weather. I can take a picture of you. Now, your picture might look nicer, have more pixels and all that. But, you know, I can do this. But here's the thing, guys. And it happened just recently. I don't even know why I was there, but I was in the Verizon store. I got a buddy that works there, and we were looking at the new phones. And all I got to do is just kind of be there and look around. And suddenly I'm like, man, this is a piece of junk. I need a new phone, you know? And I justify it. You want to know the best way to become discontented with your car after church? Hey, let's go get some lunch and let's just drive through the car lots. Let's look at the new cars. And you're driving through there and you're like, man, look at that thing. Man, this thing's a piece of this. I think this thing's rattling. This car is a, you know, and it's like a 2 years old. But you're like, man, I think I need a new car. And it happens, right? I mean, you see it. Your friend gets a new vehicle. You're like, wow, man. And suddenly we think, I got to have this. So what I got to do, because I get that urge, I'm just like, man, I need a new phone because this thing is. I just have to find my buddy that still uses the flip phone. And I'm like, let's switch for a week, right? Let me have your flip phone. And then suddenly I'm like, I need my iPhone 4 back, okay? But we have been so successful at creating discontent in us through our mass marketing. And we buy into it every year. We got to have better stuff, bigger stuff, newer stuff. And I'm guilty of this. Listen, guys, I can be out, and here's where I have to be careful. It's when I have margin, actually, and I have downtime. It's like suddenly I'm like, oh man, well, you know, I ought to go over all that. You know, I ought to check out those new tennis shoes. I saw a buddy of mine had those new shoes. Those look pretty cool. I don't need another pair of tennis shoes. I don't need new shoes. But it's like, man, that was a really awesome jacket that guy he was wearing. I wonder if they've still got some of those. Why? I don't need another jacket. But it's just, they're masters at creating this discontent. I'll tell you another area that's been successful, and that's social media. Social media, Pinterest, Facebook, Instagram, and creating this. Here's the thing. Okay, you're second grader, it's class party time, and he signed you up to bring the cupcakes. This used to not be a big deal, right? You go to Walmart, you get some Duncan Hines, whatever, and you borrow one of those pans that's got the molded little holes in it, and you mix that stuff up, you pour it in there, you bake it, pull it out, get the little plastic, icing, cover those little puppies up, you got a little extra for yourself left, and you do that, and if he's been good, put a little sprinkles, right? If not, no sprinkles, and boom, you got cupcakes. Simple, right? Not today. Mom, I gotta bring 32 cupcakes for the class party. Oh my goodness. Where do we go? Pinterest, cupcakes. And oh my word, I did this. I got on Pinterest, I did cupcakes. Good night. They don't even look like cupcakes. They look like toys. Action figures. I mean, it's like, how do you even do that? And so here, oh my, and just all this, and you got like $20 per cupcake invested in this thing. But you got to do it because it's got to look that way, right? Let me help you out here, okay? Let me help you out here. All right, my picture. Where's my picture? This is a cupcake. Tastes really good, all right? I'm a second grader. As soon as they put it in front of me and they say, go, I'm putting it in my mouth. I'm not gonna admire it. I'm not gonna take a picture of it. You already have, but I'm not. I'm gonna eat the darn thing. And the only thing I care about is it good? And it probably will be because I just had that greasy pizza and celery stick for lunch. And I got cupcakes. Now listen. Some of you are artistic. And and that's your theme. And I say, awesome. But for the rest of us, that it's not, it's just this pressure that I got to be that way. I got to do Pinterest worthy cupcakes. Not just bake those puppies and send them, my brownies, they ought to look the same. But this enormous pressure is to breed this discontent. Jesus, listen to what Jesus says. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus speaks to us. In Luke chapter 12, verse 15, he says, beware, guard against every kind of greed. Life is not measured by how much you own. The value of your life is not found in if you create Pinterest worthy cupcakes. Your image and your value may rise in a culture that doesn't value God, but God says that's not where your value lies. He goes on and he says, verse 21, a person is a fool. Harsh language. A fool to store up earthly wealth, but not have a rich relationship with God. It's not evil. Don't misunderstand. It's not evil to make Pinterest-worthy cupcakes. It's not evil. These things are. But if it consumes my margin, if it consumes my life, if it creates a discontent in my life that robs me of a rich relationship with God, then that's a problem. And Jesus says, that's foolishness. Turning to his disciples, he says, this is why I tell you not to worry about everyday life, whether you have enough food to eat or enough clothes to wear. Life is more than food and your body more than clothing. We need to get that. We need to hear that because we are so discontent with who we are. And you know what? And that is so the result of our culture. We spend our life in a culture that tells us, you know what? And if we were given a chance for a do-over, and we could do over our looks, our lot in life, whatever. I mean, most of us say, oh yeah, I'd be better looking, I'd be smarter, I'd be richer, I'd be. And yet, the reality is, if you spent the majority of your life in the presence of God, you wouldn't worry about those things. You wouldn't worry about how you looked or how much money you had, because you would realize the treasure is right here. And this relationship, not in what you think about me. And that's what Jesus is trying to get across to his followers. We dishonor God if we proclaim a Savior that satisfies, but we walk around discontented most of our life. We try to tell people that Jesus is all I need, and yet all they see and hear from us is this constant discontent. I need more. I don't have. I wish this. I wish that. I wish my life was different. I wish. And yet you're trying to tell them how awesome Jesus is and how satisfying Jesus is. It's like that doesn't add up. It doesn't make sense. That would have been like me, back in high school, being like spokesperson for Acme cream. I mean, you know, I mean, I had it bad. And it'd be like, this stuff's awesome. It'd be like, do you use it? Absolutely. There's got to be something else on the market, right? I mean, it's just like, that was crazy. But that's how so many of us are as believers. And when I walk around with my children and with my family, with my neighbors, with my friends, and I walk around discontented and I mumble and I grumble, I complain, I wish I had this, I wish I had that. And then I try to convince them that Jesus is awesome and amazing and he's everything you need. Doesn't add up. It doesn't connect. They're like, wait a minute, there's a huge disconnect here. And I'm dishonoring God when I do that. I need to learn the boundary of contentment and learning what it is to be content. I'd say most of us in this room don't even know what it is to be content. We have been so programmed that we got to need more. We got to have more. We need more. We don't have enough. We're not good enough. We don't measure up. We need this boundary of contentment. Second boundary we need is vision. We need the boundary of vision. Vision is having a clear or an increasingly clear image of a preferred future. It's not where I'm at, but it's where I'm headed. This is where I'm going. This is the life I want to have. This is the marriage I desire. This is the family I want to see. This is the ministry. This is the life that I'm looking for. This is the vision that I have. A great example of vision is like in the restaurant industry. And, you know, McDonald's led the way for years and just set the standard, and everybody was copying their motto and they were so crazy successful. And then Chick-fil-A comes along and says, let's change this up. You know, we're not going to be open 7 days a week. We're going to be closed on Sundays. That's a value. We have a vision. We have a vision of being a restaurant that honors Sunday, honors a day of worship, whether our employees choose to use it or not. We're going to be closed. They said, you know what? We're going to do one thing and we're going to try to do it well. We're going to do chicken. You want a meatloaf sandwich? You're not going to go to Chick-fil-A. You want a hamburger? You're not going to go to Chick-fil-A. You know, you want a grilled cheese? You're not going to go to Chick-fil-A. You want chicken? Come see us. We got a lot of chicken. We do it different ways. We think we do it really good. But don't come on Sundays because we're not open. And they've been successful with it. It's worked well. I mean, they're now really probably one of the industry standards and leaders in their particular field. McDonald's, I like McDonald's. Don't get me wrong. I do. I probably go to McDonald's more than Chick-fil-A. That whole coleslaw thing with Chick-fil-A has kind of got me upset. The superfood, I'm not digging. But anyway, but here's McDonald's. McDonald's, you know what McDonald's really did great? McDonald's catered to kids. And billions and billions served because billions and billions of parents took their kids to McDonald's for that Happy Meal. Burgers, fries, and a Coke, and a toy. They do it excellent. But it's like McDonald's is like, well, we got to be all things to all people. We got to expand. And so now, you know what? And you drive through the drive-thru, and then there's the big sign that says McRib is back. And you're like, where'd it go? And McRib is back. Now, I got to tell you the truth. I kind of like this thing. But I'll be honest. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's ribs or not, okay? Because it's like McDonald's ribs. I mean, the Filet-O-Fish. I mean, yeah, you know, I mean, but if you want a good fish sandwich, maybe not. But it's like the hamburger, fries, and a Coke. You do it great. But vision, you know, it's just like, maybe we do McRibs. Maybe we don't. Maybe, we, you know, it's like Chick-fil-A. It's like, we're going to do chicken. We're going to do it well. And that's it. Vision. Do you have vision when it comes to your life, when it comes to your marriage, when it comes to your children, when it comes to your ministry, when it comes to your career, when it comes to your time? Do you have vision? This is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. This is the marriage I want to have. This is what I want my marriage to look like 20 years from now. This is where I hope to see my kids 20 years from now when they're grown. Andy Stanley, pastor down in Atlanta, says this years ago, and it stuck with me. He said, everyone ends up somewhere in life. Everyone ends up somewhere in life. 20, 30 years down the road from today, you're going to be somewhere. Some people end up somewhere on purpose. Those are the ones that have vision. Are you running the race you're running today on purpose? Or are you just taking life as it comes? If you have no margin in your life, you're probably just taking it as it comes. You don't have any time to think about it. It's in your margin of your life where you develop the vision for your marriage, the vision for your children, the vision for your family. Jesus said in John 5, he said, listen, I only do what I see my Father doing. And the Father loves me and he shows me everything he's doing. And he says, that's my vision. That's what I do. And in John chapter 6, Jesus has just fed 5,000 people It's been a huge day. And the Bible says that some of the people came and they said, "This is amazing. You have performed an amazing miracle." And it says Jesus realized that the crowd wanted to make him their king. So he snuck away to a remote place to be alone. Why? Because Jesus' vision wasn't to be their king, their earthly king, and overthrow the Roman Empire. And that wasn't his vision. I mean, this was great. I mean, think about it. Jesus traded the opportunity to be an earthly king, the royal scepter, the royal robe, you know, to lead the people to overthrow the Roman Empire, to be this great leader, this great military strategist, this great king, and thousands and perhaps millions of people to follow him and live as a king and have all this popularity and fame and power right here on earth. And yet he exchanged that to be publicly humiliated and stripped naked and beaten and nailed to a cross. Now, in the eyes of culture, that was crazy. You're crazy to pass up an opportunity like that. Not if you understand that the cross was not unexpected. The cross was not an accident. The cross was not a bump in the road. The cross was not, "Oh gosh, I didn't think about this." The cross was the vision. The cross was the goal. The cross was the plan. To set up an earthly kingdom was not part of his plan, so he didn't go for that. It was to go to the cross. That was his vision. That was what the Father gave him, and that's what he did. And that vision was a boundary in his life. "No, I'm not going to be your king. No, I'm not going to go to this town. No, I'm not going to go over here. I'm only going to do what the Father leads me and tells me to do. And right now he's telling me to do this." And that was where he went. And that was the boundary in his life. Do you have that kind of vision for your marriage? You know what? Sadly, if we're honest, a lot of times if someone guessed what our vision for our marriage was based upon the amount of time that we've invested in our marriage over the past year, they might conclude that our vision for our marriage is, "Who cares?" Because we really haven't done anything to invest in our marriage. And a lot of times we haven't invested in our marriage because we have no margin. And we have no margin because we have no boundaries in our life protecting our time and our relationships and the direction. And so when this opportunity comes, says, "Hey, would you be a part of this? Hey, we'd like to give you a promotion. We see how hard you work. You've done really great. We'd like to promote you to regional manager." It's a lot more work. It's a lot more travel. You'll be gone a lot more, but it is a lot more money. See, the person with vision that says, "So I'll be out at least 3 nights a week." You know what? We have a vision for our home that at least 85% of the evenings we want to have dinner together, and we're going to invest in our kids. So you know what? I'm going to have to pass on that promotion. This is like a 15% raise, man. I mean, think of what you could do. I mean, think of what you could, how much more you could provide for your family. That'd be awesome. And sure, I love my family. I'd love to provide more. But you know what? I'm not going to sacrifice mealtime for that. Now, you, in a lot of cases, you'd be laughed at. You might even lose your job. Say, "Well, look, man, this really isn't an option for you." See, when I have vision as a boundary, vision helps me establish my priorities. And my priorities help me to know whether the answer is yes or no. It makes it a lot easier to answer that question. The answer is no, because this is a boundary, and I'm determined I'm not going to violate it. And for me to do that would violate this boundary. For me to be a part of that mission, to me to be a part of that team would violate this boundary, and I'm not going to do it. Do you have a vision for your life, or are you just kind of taking life as it comes? Because you'll end up somewhere. You may not like where you end up. You may end up with a lot of regrets. Some people will end up somewhere on purpose. Those are the ones that have vision. Those are the ones that have a boundary around their life and say, no, I'm not going to sacrifice that for this. Last boundary we need in our life. Let me say this about vision. We got to get to the place where we're okay saying no to many good things so that we can say yes to a few best things. And that's where we get in trouble. There's a lot of good opportunities, but we got to know what it is God's called us to, so we can say no to all those good things and say yes only to the best things, the things that are going to help me accomplish the vision that God's given me for my family, for my marriage, for my ministry. The third boundary is Sabbath. Contentment, vision, and Sabbath. The idea of the Sabbath was established in the Old Testament when God gave the law to Moses. And he said, 6 days you can do your work, but on the seventh, it's the Sabbath. You keep it holy. You rest. Don't do any work. Your family, your servants, your animals, nobody works. It's a day of rest. It's a Sabbath unto the Lord. Two things God told Moses to tell the people about the Sabbath in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy chapter 5. It's to be a day of rest and a day to remember. It's not just a day to rest, but it's a day to remember. He says, remember how God brought you out of slavery in Egypt. And the idea of Sabbath in the New Testament and in our day to day, the idea of Sabbath is that it is a day of rest. We need a day of rest. It's that 80% margin we talked about. One day out of seven. I need, you know, if I take one day and just set it aside to rest and to remember, I mean, I still got 80% of my week to get things done. Set aside the Sabbath. It's a day of rest, but it's also a day to remember. To remember that according to the scriptures, the Bible says in the New Testament that I once was dead in my trespasses and sins, but I've been made alive together with Christ. I'm a new creation in Christ Jesus, and I need to remember that. I need to remind myself of the gospel. I need to proclaim the gospel to myself on a regular basis. Don't forget what God has done for me. Yeah, I may be losing in the eyes of culture. I may not be gaining because I'm turning down promotions or I'm saying no to opportunities because I have some vision and this boundary. And I may be losing some things in the eyes of culture. But man, I am reminding myself of whose I am. I belong to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. I belong to Christ. And I don't want to forget what He's done for me, the sacrifice. He went to the cross for me so that I could live, not so that I could be so busy and have no margin in my life and lose my family, lose my relationships, lose my mind. No, He went to the cross so that I could have life, life with margin, where I could meet with Him and encounter Him and see God show up in my life and do the amazing things. That's what He's, and I got to remind myself, and Sabbath allows me to step back from everything else and just be still and gather with other believers and celebrate and remind each other of what God has done for us. When we come together like this, it's important. It matters. And yet we're not doing so good with Sabbath and having Sabbaths in our lives today. This chart tells us, according to the Centers for Disease Control, 48% of Americans are getting enough rest. So over half of Americans are not getting enough rest, just physical rest. We're sleep deprived. We're pushing the limits. 36%. This is down from 48% in 2004. To 36% of Americans actively attend church on a regular basis. And that's a little skewed because the definition of actively attend has changed. And in 2004, actively attending church meant that you attended a minimum of three out of four Sundays a month. Today, active, what people consider actively attending church, is a minimum of about two times out in a 6 week period. So it's what is active attendance has shifted and changed. So about a third are actually attending church with any regularity. It's pausing to come together in some capacity, in some form, somewhere, and gather with other believers and celebrate and worship and remember whose they are and what God has done. 26% of Americans report that they read their Bible on a weekly basis. About a fourth actually read their Bibles. So 75% aren't even reading their Bibles with regularity to even really know what God's Word teaches, what God's standards are, what it looks like, what godly vision would even look like. Because we don't take Sabbaths. We work. Some of you got to run off to commitments this afternoon. And some of these are work commitments. I get that. But you know what? When I was a kid, we didn't have ball practice on Sundays. We didn't play games on Sunday. It was just our culture. Even our culture recognized, hey, people go to church. I remember when the stores didn't open till 1 o'clock on Sundays and they would close at 6. Because so many people went to church. Now, you have to be in church. You don't have to be informed. We can gather together in houses, in homes, on mountaintops. I get that. But the idea is we're eroding that value of coming together and taking a day to say, let's stop the work. Let's stop the crazy and let's rest and let's enjoy family and friends and one another. And let's remember who our Creator is. Let's remember what God has done for us. Let's remember whose we are and who we serve. Let's consider, do we have enough margin? Do we have a vision? How are we doing with our vision? Let's have some Sabbath in our life, and we have none today. Do you have the boundaries of contentment, vision, and Sabbath? Or is your life a marginless life? I think there's a great price to pay if we have no margin, if we're discontented, if we have no vision, we're just taking it as it comes, and we have no Sabbath. The consequences are burnout. Emotional, relational, spiritual. It's burnout. It's not what God desires for you. We need those boundaries. We need those boundaries to protect our margin. I want to encourage you to consider contentment and vision and Sabbath this week. Let me pray for you. Jesus, thank you for loving us. Thank you for coming. Not that we might be busy and overdrawn and overscheduled and overworked and hurried and hasty and empty and frustrated and tired, but you came that we might have life and have it abundantly. And God, I believe the only way we can know that abundant life is to have margin in our life, to have some vision, to understand contentment so that we don't feel the need to run hard after a lot of these things, to have some space in our lives for quiet, for family time, for date nights, to work on marriages, to work on relationships, to consider our vision and to lay out our schedules in our lives, to be alone with you, some Sabbaths, Lord. I pray, God, help us in this area because we are struggling, Lord. And we have a great enemy, and our culture is spending lots and lots of resources to keep us discontented, to keep us busy so that we don't have time to think about vision and Sabbath and be still and focus on you and focus on the relationships that truly matter and where we're going in life. God, help us to consider these things seriously and carefully this week. And I pray, Lord, should there be any person in here this morning, Lord, that does not have a personal relationship with you, does not understand what does it even mean to be a Christian? What does it even mean to be in a relationship with God? Father, I pray this morning that you would speak to their heart and you would just give them the courage perhaps to go back to the prayer room and talk with one of our folks back there, or to fill out the blue card and say, you know, I'd like to talk to someone about this. I've got some questions. I'm curious. I don't think I fully understand. I'd like to know what that is. I pray you'd give them the courage to respond today and say, I'd like to know more. Father, as always, I trust you to do what only you can do. I trust you to speak to our hearts. I share what I feel you gave me to share, and I pray that you will just challenge us and encourage us, God, to pay attention to these things this week. And I pray this in Jesus' wonderful name. Amen.